Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeted.
The time is now to turn the math around.
It is time for Pollock and Thurston on this final Wednesday of the month of July, heading into SummerSlam weekend, where we are heading to Cleveland, not Detroit.
Not Detroit. I hope I drive to the right city.
Yes. Brandon had some, he has just been on this whirlwind of WWE events that he has to keep track of what cities he is punching into his GPS. But man, we have a packed show today. We are going to be giving you, the viewer, the extra VIP treatment today, because we have some massive stories to be going through, including always a match made in heaven, Brandon Thurston and documents that he has come into a union of and has produced a great report. How did Las Vegas secure WrestleMania out of the hands of Minnesota? And as well, do we owe you a congratulations, Brandon? Was there a ruling in your favor over this past week that seems to be the best kept secret in wrestling circles, legal circles, and even to you that had to find this out independently?
It crossed my mind. Was it yesterday that I shared this link with you? It crossed my mind yesterday. You know, there are various things that I'm checking on, not as often as I should, but there are various things that I'm checking on daily or every few days. And one of those things is this, the status of my records request to the Texas governor for information related to Royal Rumble 2023, which was in San Antonio. When I made that request, the governor's office asked for a ruling from the AG, which is what tends to happen in Texas. And so I checked on it yesterday and found that, the AG has ruled. They have issued a ruling letter saying that certain information must be released. Some information can be withheld. I can't tell you what that information is. I can't see it because they would be releasing it to me if they let me see it. But certain information can be withheld, but all the rest of the information has to be released. So I followed up and I asked the public information representative for the governor's office to release that to me, and I'm still waiting for a response.
Okay, well, the time is ticking, and maybe once this is all settled, we can have your pal Ken Paxton on the show.
Maybe. I did watch the other night a full presentation. It was from 2019, so not the newest, but I did watch a full presentation that is on the Texas AG's YouTube channel of basically like a training PowerPoint presentation on public records law. It was a thrilling experience for me personally.
I think everyone out there would be binge watching this too. I mean, is this, maybe if this shows up on Netflix, if they pick up a second season of this. This sounds like tremendous programming.
Yes. It's not with Ms. Tamara Smith. It's with a different guy who I think it was in her job at that time. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll put in the request. I'll state this. We would like to have Ken Paxton on the show, and we are the only media outlet in the world that will be requesting Ken Paxton and will not bring up Donald Trump once. They might do it. Like what? Okay. We just want to chat about the disclosure of WWE-related documents with Ken,
which
Paxton.
I'm sure he knows a lot about. He's into the weeds on that, I'm sure. Yeah.
He'll send one of his underlings to deal with us. All right. Well, let's get into things. We don't have any time to waste. Let us start off with Brandon's latest reporting. I want to send everyone over, not this second, but you can have a two-screen experience perhaps. Pull up WrestleNomics.com because Brandon has put together a great encapsulation of how many documents did you receive on Friday night, Brandon? You sent me a screen grab of this, and my eyes almost fell out when you had designated the page count that had been sent to you from the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Authority.
Yes, 2,800 some odd pages were sent to me in a PDF. Most of them were emails that were not interesting because they were like, when you do a records request, a large part of what they're doing in the response to your records request is they're searching for WWE in this case in all of their emails. And what I get are, you know, various newsletters from Sports Business Journal that happen to mention WWE and WWE promotional emails. It's, you know, like tune into Raw that, you know, employees have subscribed to. So I weeded it down to about 300 pages is what we got here of 300 pertinent pages to what I was interested in here. So that was, I was watching the opening ceremonies of the Olympics on Friday night, but whoa, I got a big Rutgers West. And I should say, you know, the LVCVA, which is the organization that made the deal, with WWE, who I sent this records request to, they were diligent in sending me updates. So it reassured me that they were paying attention to my records request. They would give me form updates. I got numerous, updates that we don't have anything for you now, but we'll follow up with you on this date. And then they would and so forth. And then finally I did get the response on Friday.
Would this rank, near the top of government agencies that you have dealt with? Would this be on the top tier?
Quality government service from the LVCVA. There are a number of entities who shall remain nameless who have, you know, I haven't heard from in a long time, and I have outstanding records request lists, certainly.
Yeah, your photo may be hung in some offices as a warning for people. Do not respond to this individual.
Do not engage.
Anyway, so some of the keynotes that come out of this are, I mean, mainly they center around how WrestleMania ends up in Las Vegas next year, because if we rewind just the beginning of April, it was not Las Vegas that was the prevailing rumor of where WrestleMania would be landing next year. Instead, Minnesota seemed to be the front runner, and WrestleMania weekend came and went without an announcement. I think that raised some eyebrows. Is this, has there been a snag? Is there another potential location? And lo and behold, it ended up being Las Vegas. And this was not some long-term play by Las Vegas. Like, this came together relatively quickly, and to the point that, like, in Minnesota, one of the representatives had even been public about dangling this, that one of these, an event second only to the Super Bowl will be coming to Minneapolis, and we hope to be announcing it soon. Like, they were, dare I say, in the red zone when it came to announcing this WrestleMania for 2025.
Right. So on March 6th, what you're referring to is the president of the Minnesota organization, the Minnesota Sports and Events Commission, Wendy Blackshaw. She spoke before the Minnesota House of Representatives and alluded to a big event that they couldn't announce right that moment on March 6th, but they were hoping to announce soon. And it would have an economic impact only second to the Super Bowl, however that is interpreted. And everybody believes that she must be referring to, the WrestleMania that fits as maybe something that's second only to the Super Bowl. I don't know if they're the Olympics.
What about the Olympics?
Yeah, the Olympics might have a significant economic impact in Paris right now. In any case, a lot of speculation was that it would be Minnesota, and that supported that. However, around that time, if you remember, there was the WrestleMania kickoff show in T-Mobile Arena, and back on February 7th, there are emails. There's actually a reporter who asks someone from the LVCVA if they were looking into bringing WrestleMania to Las Vegas in 2026. That seemed more reasonable, more believable. But the LVCVA did set up a meeting with a UFC executive. I think he's now formerly a TKO live events executive now, Peter Dropic. Looks like they had a meeting on March 4th. And that seems to be the moment where the ball really got rolling on this becoming an actuality, that WrestleMania would come to Las Vegas on next year, April 19th and 20th in 2025.
So what comes with this is a $5 million grant that's part of this incentive package from the LVCVA. And this also includes rent-free usage of the Las Vegas Convention Center, West Hall, no word on the East Hall and its occupants that weekend. And this is a pretty significant upgrade from several years ago when SummerSlam was hosted in Las Vegas. This was right after the return of fans in 2021, and they held SummerSlam at Allegiant Stadium. And to contrast, they received a $300,000 site fee for that SummerSlam, along with an additional $30,000 in marketing value as well. So now we're into the millions.
Yes. And so give you some idea, I guess, of what the fair price is for these events. We know now that WrestleMania, in, let's say, 2022 in Dallas, that got something that looks like to be around $5.2 million. That's what Sports Business Journal reported a few weeks ago. The documents show maybe $8.9 million. So I'm not sure how to interpret that. In any case, we'll put that to the side for the moment. But that lines up with the $5.2 million that we have here for Dallas in 2022. That lines up with what Las Vegas is giving just in terms of a site fee. It seems that that is cash. There's also, as you mentioned, there will be free use of the convention center for the world, the former Access event. There's going to be marketing value as usual throughout the city that the Las Vegas organization will provide. But so it gives you the idea that WrestleMania is in the multiple millions, which makes sense. It's two stadium events. There are the adjoining events in the arenas for Raw and SmackDown and the NXT event as well, and all the indie events that coalesce during that weekend. And then at a much lower value are the Royal Rumble and SummerSlam, at least insofar as what we know of them. $300,000 for SummerSlam in Las Vegas in 2021, $300,000 and some marketing value for the Houston. I don't know if that's a marketing value, I should say. $323,000 for Royal Rumble in 2020, just before the pandemic. We know that Tampa St. Pete gave $500,000 for Royal Rumble this year. We don't know about San Antonio Royal Rumble. Maybe we'll find out someday soon. But then there's this other category though of these international events. We have two of them. I guess if Puerto Rico counts as international outside the continental United States, $1.8 million for Backlash in Puerto Rico. And what was implied to be an equivalent of $2.8 million US for Clash of the Castle in Cardiff. So we're starting to piece together maybe the going rates for what these events are worth.
Yeah, and maybe we'll get into that a little later on about at least what one analyst firm is looking at very aggressively when it comes to the future of site fees within the TKO umbrella with WWE and UFC. Some lofty goals in the years to come. But sticking with this article, there's a number of interesting exchanges that you also got eyes on here in between Lisa Motley of the LVCVA receiving this Star Tribune article back in March about WrestleMania being a finalist for Minneapolis. And she received this article and her response was, "Yikes," she replied. Motley noted that a UFC executive told her that Minneapolis hadn't yet been informed that they were no longer in contention for WrestleMania. "They should probably do that soon," Motley wrote back to an ad executive from R&R Partners. And thus Minneapolis, yikes, got the news that they would not be getting WrestleMania. And instead, they will be getting SummerSlam, not next summer, but in 2026 for two nights at US Bank Stadium.
Right, which I guess is kind of a consolation prize. We have seen quotes though from Wendy Blackshaw, who represents the Minnesota organization, you know, saying that they were disappointed, and she said it was because of new ownership, which I don't know if that's supported in here and what we've uncovered. You can decide for yourself.
Was there an ownership change in March?
No, there was. The merger was closed in September 2023. And it seems, you know, if she is in fact alluding to WrestleMania in her March sixth comments to the Minnesota House of Representatives, that's well after the closure of the merger and almost 1 year since the deal was done and was started.
Does it give you any kind of thought into, like, if you're Minneapolis? I don't think WWE wanted to leave. They were obviously far enough with Minneapolis. They wanted to have some kind of consolation prize, but they're not getting WrestleMania in 2026. They're not getting WrestleMania in 2027. Instead, they're getting a two-night SummerSlam event that you would think, like, if you're aiming for this economic impact, you want the stronger of the two events and what that entails as well. Do you read into that potentially that maybe they're looking at WrestleMania just being outside of what Minneapolis was willing to provide regarding site fees? Like, they have a higher ceiling of what they feel a WrestleMania can fetch than what Minneapolis was maybe willing to commit.
Yeah, that's a possibility that's not answered in what I've reported here. It could have been just the fact that there was a higher bid from Las Vegas once they started to talk to Las Vegas, and that was just that made it a more attractive. And people will probably think of the cold weather that we experienced in Philadelphia. I would keep in mind, though, that all of this negotiating was before WrestleMania in Philadelphia took place. And that email exchange that you just brought up, where it looks like Minnesota is out of the running and Las Vegas is pretty sure going to get it. That's all before WrestleMania has happened. So we haven't had that experience of, oh, this is a cold weather. We can't have a cold weather WrestleMania. That hasn't happened yet. And certainly Las Vegas would be warmer than Minnesota, but, that whole experience had not happened yet. Even, and nonetheless, US Bank Stadium is an indoor stadium, right? I think.
Yes.
Okay. So in any case, that's what's happening there. And we did have an exchange between, Lisa Motley of Las Vegas and, Dave Beachnow from the Detroit Sports Commission, where he was checking with her. Now, this is way back in June of 2023. So this is not in this time frame of the WrestleMania negotiations, but ahead of last year's SummerSlam in Detroit. And he was asking if Las Vegas paid a site fee for SummerSlam in 2022. Lisa Motley confirmed that they did $300,000, and they also provided $30,000 in marketing value, which is all, if you've ever been to one of these big PLEs in the city, you'll see lots of branding and banners hanging from the streetlights, the merchandise store. We were in Detroit. I was in Detroit, and I saw, you know, there were even things on the sidewalk. There were giant faces of Roman Reigns and Jey Uso on the side of buildings. It's like we were in a cult of personality, a government where Roman Reigns was the leader or something. So there's that stuff. And there is, you know, there is some discussion in here in this email exchange between, the sports commission executive from Detroit and the sports commission executive, from Las Vegas about, being squeezed. Dave Beachnow from, Detroit is saying they're trying to squeeze us for more, value here in terms of, he's talking about the marketing value, which apparently is not something that he had experienced before when dealing with another executive by the name of John Sabour, who is now a former longtime, WWE live events executive. So I think it indicates something about the ambition and the difference in strategy of the current, set of executives who are pursuing these site fees very aggressively versus what came before.
And very open with one another about their site fees. I mean,
yes.
Just contact another. How much did you guys pay? This is what we paid.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
The disclosure of information, it helps everybody.
Right. And I did speak with Dave Beachnow this morning or this afternoon. And he just made clear that, you know, that SummerSlam was a very successful event and he's eager to work with WWE again. So it wasn't in a sense of like some unhappiness with WWE, but we just wanted to make that clear that, you know, that it does illustrate a difference. And we did get some clarity here by way of publishing these emails about what the site fees actually are.
Yeah. And kind of adjacent to this story was also the visit last week that Paul Levesque and Nick Khan had in London, England with their mayor, Sadiq Khan. And
yes, and their tiny belt.
With the tiny belt that seems to have gotten a lot of focus on what this means. Maybe this means.
Were they trying to create a meme? Was that what do you think was going on there?
Do you think they're thinking at that level? That's like, That's the 4D chess level that I think is overthinking things too much. But nonetheless, it did become quite the focused upon takeaway from that photo op. But nonetheless, I mean, you do this photo op, and I guess the big question that everyone has is, you know, London notoriously is not one of those places that is wanting for major events in terms of having to pay for them. And as Brandon has laid out here, like, you can see what they are trying to achieve, especially led by WrestleMania, of, you know, how badly would a London want a WrestleMania when it has, you know, such big events on a pretty routine basis that it is not paying for. I mean, this was, you know, famously last year or 2 years ago when they ended up doing Clash at the Castle in Wales rather than a larger area like London, for instance. Well, Cardiff was willing to pay them.
Yeah, I think that is one factor. Let's take Las Vegas, though. I think of Las Vegas as a pretty tourist-heavy destination. It's not one of the biggest cities in the United States, like New York or LA or Chicago, but it is, I would say, a pretty heavy tourist place, you know. What we're thinking with London is, look, this is one of the biggest cities in the world. It's probably one of the most, you know, one of the most attractive tourist destinations. Do they really need to lay down a few million dollars to attract WrestleMania? Maybe not. I think the calculation is, what's my hotel vacancy occupancy like in a time like April, where we're going to have WrestleMania? And is there a vacancy in our hospitality businesses that could accommodate this and therefore benefit from it? So I think that's a large part of the calculation there is, you know, maybe London is a relatively slow time, for hotels. I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. Judging by they're having a meeting and then they're willing to take pictures together, this seems like something that might actually happen. So maybe that is the case, that London could benefit from an increase in tourists coming into London around the time of WrestleMania.
And also WrestleMania next year being Easter weekend. So that is, you know, something for, I don't know how many people their destination for Easter weekend is Las Vegas to travel, but it will be for wrestling fans next year.
Right. And we didn't get a ton of clarity about why they chose Easter weekend instead of earlier in April, which WrestleMania almost always is. I think for one thing, we believe that they don't want to run during the Final Four, which memorably was happening this year. But that's at least part of it. So I didn't get a clear answer about why. We do see them discussing various dates, though, in the course of these records that we have.
All right. The whole story can be found at WrestleNomics.com, going through a lot of these facts, figures, and comments on the record as Brandon Thurston holding these people to account. But great reporting, Brandon. I was very impressed that you went through 2,900 pages of documents, and then I got the update. I've parsed it down to a cool 300, which is a nice little, you know, summertime read. Yeah. A small
the Adobe Acrobat license that I paid for recently is really paying off. A wise investment, I have to say.
Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to BadlandsRanch.com/save50 today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
The other major story that broke last night was, so a few weeks ago, Judge Boulware had somewhat surprisingly not rubber stamped the $335 million settlement in the two antitrust cases filed against the UFC, one led by the Kung Lee class of fighters, the other by the Cajun Johnson, tier of fighters. So it was stated that, you know, a decision would be made by the next Friday, and that Friday came and went. And then last week came and went, and this decision was put off until Tuesday night, when several people keeping a keen eye on their Pacer updates saw that Richard Boulware put down his decision and rejected this $335 million settlement involving the two classes of fighters. And the next steps involve a status conference that will take place on August the 19th and laying down a potential trial date to start for the Kung Lee class on October the 28th. And the Kung Lee portion covers about 1,200 fighters. And just to compare, the $335 million settlement, while that might sound on its surface like a pretty sizable amount of money, I mean, Brandon and I together could probably hit that amount. It's not insignificant.
We'll talk to our VCs. Yeah,
that's it. We might need one angel investor, but their original amount that they were seeking was between $800 million and $1.6 billion, which, given this case, you could also get treble damages. So then we're talking up to a ceiling of $4.8 billion. So this naturally scared a lot of Wall Street when these cases were looming, and you're looking at the potential of treble damages. So when that $335 million settlement came down, yeah, it's a nine-figure judgment, but it's, or a nine-figure settlement, but it was a lot less than what the worst case scenario was. And Wall Street reacted pretty favorably to that and has been constantly brought up by a lot of investors and analysts. The fact that now this albatross is off the shoulders of TKO and they can move forward uninhibited by these looming antitrust cases. So this was a big change. And I'm curious, Brandon, how has the stock reacted today in the hours since this has come out? Has there been any noticeable reaction to this news of a possible trial in October?
It was down pretty strongly when the market opened this morning, and well below the indexes, but it's kind of flattened out here. The indexes are up on the day, and TKO has now gone about break even on the day. So this is not disastrous by any means, but it does seem to be reacting to it.
I did reach out to Eric Kramer. He's the lead attorney for the plaintiffs, and his statement was that the plaintiffs respect the court's ruling rejecting the proposed global resolution of the Lee and Johnson cases, and accordingly will be moving forward full speed on all fronts as directed by the court. We now plan on ramping up preparations in Lee for the imminent trial, and also will begin pressing forward with discovery in Johnson. At the same time, with the interests of our clients and the classes at the forefront, we are also open to re-engaging with the UFC to see whether the parties could reach a settlement building off of the momentum achieved in the prior settlement, but working to satisfy the court's expressed concerns with the resolution, in particular to eliminate several of the issues expressed by the court regarding the prior proposed combined settlement of Lee and Johnson. The plaintiffs believe the best path forward, if a new settlement becomes a possibility, is to attempt to resolve the two cases separately, focusing first on the Lee case, given its imminent trial date, and using the progress made to date as a jumping off point for further discussions. Thus, while the plaintiff's focus will be on preparing for trial, we are keeping an open mind with respect to a potential new resolution. At root, plaintiffs want nothing more and nothing less than justice for the professional MMA fighters we have represented for more than 10 years in the most efficient and effective way possible. So we will move forward as if there's a trial, but we're willing to negotiate a greater settlement, which it's a very unique set of circumstances, Brandon, that you have both parties that were in alignment. They were in agreement to this figure. And now you've got to negotiate something that is not really, you know, convincing either side of what is a suitable amount. It's more so it's suiting the belief of Judge Bulwer and what he feels is fair.
Yeah, and we don't have much of an explanation, do we? We've got an 8K that was filed just as we were going to air here from TKO, where I don't know if there's any new information in here. I'm highlighting that they've noted that the court has not issued an opinion explaining its reasoning at this time. So I take it that in TKO's perspective, Judge Bulwer has not offered a reason why he's rejecting this settlement. It's a $335 million settlement. You would know better than I would how much money that means each fighter is really going to get. You know, I've heard people talk about this case in that, you know, it looks like the judge is going to reject it. Now the judge has. Is this not, I mean, you've got two parties, as you said, who agreed to it. And is this a case of, you know, like government overreach where you've got two parties who want to settle, but you're saying, no, you can't settle?
I think that's going to be the belief that many have. And it's going to be different for various fighters. There's a number of fighters, especially from the Kung Lee case class of fighters, that they were looking at a substantial amount of money. And this has been a 10-year ongoing case that the idea of being this close to the finish line where real money is going to be, like, there are some fighters here that, you know, you're looking for not an insignificant percentage of
their tens of thousands of dollars per fighter, roughly, depending on who you are.
Some more, like some you're talking in the six figure range, some even higher when you're talking about your elite level of class fighters. However, there's also the fighters, and this is more concentrated in the Cajun Johnson side, who had signed these waivers and they were capped at $3,000. And I think that really did set, Judge Boulware to look at this. Like, there were a number of fighters that were getting the short end of the stick, and we don't even know if, because Conor McGregor is one of those fighters that would have fallen into both classes, and he could get an amount from the Kung Lee case, but he could also have signed this waiver for the second class, and think of all the money he's generated, and he could have been capped at $3,000 for that side of things. And other fighters like an Israel Adesanya, a Sean O'Malley, for instance, like stars with the UFC that may very well have signed this boilerplate language in these contracts and been restricted to $3,000. So I can see different fighters having different opinions of this. And for the lawyers involved, like, they've been working at this for 10 years and they were looking at about $100 million or so dollars that they would be getting for their time over the last 10 years, I think. And ultimately, like, yeah, there's the potential for an even greater reward, but you're gambling by going to trial that, you know, if you don't get a favorable jury, all you need is one dissenting jury member and you get nothing. And I don't know how.
We can only assume that what Judge Boulware thinks that $335 million is not enough. And it's obviously not enough if he's willing to reject the settlement.
Yeah, I think so. And that ultimately becomes, I think, you know, that the plaintiffs made such a compelling case that they obviously swayed Judge Boulware into believing like this is like he absolutely believes like this is a company that has tremendous leverage and power over its fighters and have been for years. And believing that this is that the fighters are getting the short end of the stick in the settlement. But it becomes very difficult to negotiate a settlement where, again, you are. Like, do you not have to operate with the idea that we have to at least reach the floor of what we were asking for? Like, where do you even start? Like, we had agreed at 335. Are we now starting talks? Like, it must be 800 million. Like, that has to be our starting point. I'm not volunteering to go to the floor if I'm the UFC. I was like, we had an agreement here. I'm certain that the UFC is going to be very loud about this being overreach. Like, here were two parties that were willing to reach this. And even if that might be sympathetic to a jury that says, hey, these fighters were happy with the original settlement. Why are we making such a gigantic, upgrade in the settlement here? I can understand being nervous about going to trial. If you're either side, there are aspects of, what is at stake.
And it's only the Lee case that has a tentative trial date, October 28th. Both of these cases are in Nevada. Will you be traveling to Nevada and benefiting the tourism industry if this goes to trial?
Well, you actually pointed out that there is a lawyer in Buffalo that is listed on this.
So I think this is like a nuisance case or somebody who's not genuinely involved in this case is trying to get involved in it. I read more.
That's unfortunate because I was hoping that here we're going to get like a third party lawyer that somehow argues for a change of venue, move it to Buffalo, and I'm there.
No, unfortunately, I don't think so. I thought so at first, but no. Yes, there's someone from Buffalo who's claiming some involvement here. I'm not sure that it's genuine though.
I pulled this up. This was from July 12th. This was a reporter, Josh Gross. He was in the court when Judge Boulware, this was the hearing where he made the first announcement that he was not just rubber stamping this. And some of his notes, he stated that Judge Boulware's main concerns were, number one, the conflict between the classes. The Lee case, it's simply focused on those are monetary damages, whereas Johnson, it focused on injunctive relief that would have more effect on contract language and really changing the way the UFC does business. Number two were, are the monetary damages sufficient? Judge Boulware addressed the amount of money awarded to the fighters in the settlement and how it's being distributed, especially compared to what fighters could win at trial with treble damages. Number three, many of the Johnson class members signed the class action antitrust waivers that are not now standard in UFC contracts. There was a lot of talk about this issue. Bulware was concerned that due to the waiver, many current fighters won't receive a meaningful cash award, which we had just gone over. And number four being that Bulware discussed the plaintiff counsel's incentive to settle. He was clear that he wasn't suggesting any wrongdoing. However, he intimated that the push to settle could cost the Johnson members twice, leaving them without the big money rewards or a practical legal recourse moving forward, being that they've signed these waivers. They can't take up any issues in future because they have to go to arbitration, and they're not even getting a giant monetary reward for that sacrifice. So I think a lot of this is sympathy towards those in the Cage and Johnson class that, I mean, at least for a lot of the Lee fighters, most are getting at least something substantial as opposed to $3,000 you're capped at.
Yeah. And I'm sure this is something that other wrestling organizations and combat sports organizations, for that matter, are watching. It's not just that it affects TKO and therefore it affects WWE. I would think if this does go to trial, that there could be precedents and case law that's created that could support other issues between independent contractors or other kinds of workers in WWE and AEW, for that matter.
Well, as we talk about precedents, Lightshed Media went into precedence because they're trying to get their head around this NBA lawsuit that has been filed by Warner Brothers Discovery. And perhaps it's WWE that always can provide the answers. And they went deep. They went back to June of 2000 when the WWF was on its way out the door at the USA Network, and they were ready to jump on board with Viacom. And the USA Network stated, hey, we matched. And thus we had this actually did go in front of a judge, who did rule that this was not a sufficient match by the USA Network. And this paved the way for the WWF to leave the USA Network and go to, what was then, the Nashville Network, that became the National Network, that became Spike TV, and
now Paramount Network.
Yes. And then for the unprecedented amount, Brandon, of $28 million per year. For the rights to
deal.
Raw and shoulder programming as well. I mean, this was considered what a gigantic leap. Pro wrestling getting $28 million a year for its programming. This is wild. And, so in essence, we can go through this article, but what it comes down to is the fact that like this had to be pretty much matching this point for point. This is not left for a ton of interpretation. Like, hey, this is equal to this in our own way. It's pretty much like a one-to-one comparison of what was Viacom offering from just promotion, from all of its, just all of the vertical integration that they have and where they can promote this. And I mean, they were talking at the time about amusement parks having rides after WWF characters, of using its radio properties, billboards, things that the USA Network could not compete with. And it was simply ruled like this is not a match. And they're trying to extrapolate this to Warner Brothers Discovery, trying to make its argument that, you know, Max is a comparable to Prime, and the fact that they're trying to match a combined linear television and streaming deal for what is a strictly streaming deal from Prime, and basically painting this picture that this is a pretty uphill battle for WBD to climb.
Yes. So my understanding, and I think there's a very good chance that if this doesn't get settled very quickly, that when the NBA defends itself, that case will be used as case law, that WF versus USA Network case. So what I take is happening here, there are at least two elements that the NBA will likely lean on. It's that there's superior reach streaming wise, certainly when it comes to Amazon Prime Video versus Max, just because of the homes that Prime Video is in versus Max. And there's a cash issue here, it seems. A lot of this is redacted in the complaint, so we don't have a clear view, but there's been reporting on this that Amazon Prime Video, well, Amazon is going to give the NBA some upfront payments. And WBD reportedly has offered instead to give the NBA a line of credit. So it seems what has happened here is that Amazon has promised to give all this upfront cash to the NBA, which is not something that WBD can match in the same sense. it does almost seem, which is what WBD alleges in part in this complaint, that this was kind of a deal that was designed to make it difficult for WBD to genuinely match. But the issue in what could be case law for this new complaint is that they're attempting to match, but they're not matching exactly in the same way. They are giving something that WBD is arguing is equal, but it is not exactly the same thing. So therefore it is not a genuine match. Will probably be the defense that, that the NBA gives. So we are no, the moral of the story here, as far as AEW TV rights, we're all been sitting around waiting for this NBA deal to get done. It's probably essentially done at this point, but it's just a question of, does WBD get any kind of cash settlement out of the NBA because of this to make this go away? Do they get some kind of small NBA package that's carved out of the current games that are a part of the NBA TV broadcasts? All remains unclear.
I think it's going to be quite the appraisal of David Zaslav by the way this whole NBA thing shakes out. I think that there is going to be a lot of focus on David Zaslav and how he handles this by the end of it. And I mean, there is the side, the immediate thought is the loss of the NBA is going to be detrimental. There's also the other side of this, that they're going to have an enormous windfall of savings from all of this. And you just can't predict like what long-term impact this is going to have on Warner Brothers Discovery. It could be a blessing in disguise, even if the immediate loss of the NBA is going to hurt them and almost assuredly will affect carriage fees, advertising. But long term, like, this is a very cash-strapped company to the point that like this line of credit that they needed just to be able to try and match this 3-year amount being placed in escrow. I mean, it tells you like the debt that they are operating in. It's, you could argue if it's even prudent that they should be going after the NBA at this stage of the game where they are financially.
Yeah. So is this good or bad news for AEW? Is it bad because you lose the NBA and then therefore you don't have the NBA vehicle to help promote AEW, which they do? You see some lower thirds and stuff like that during NBA games for AEW. Or is it good for AEW because if you're losing your most important content on TNT, does that make you hold on a little bit tighter to the content that you have, including AEW? I would point out, though, that I don't think AEW is strongly driving carriage fees, which are the main thing at risk here when the NBA goes away. AEW Dynamite does pretty good ratings. The other programs do better than replacement programming, but it's not something that I think is tied tightly to carriage value. And does it mean that UFC is gonna be potentially something that WBD goes after?
I was going to flip it to you that I don't think AEW is enough of a, like, it's an amount that, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery is not going to be, the outcome of this is not going to be, can we produce enough to match or to meet an offer for AEW? I think that deal is going to go through. The bigger question is this bad for UFC in that, you know, if they are concentrated on maintaining the NBA, what kind of health is WBD going to be in come next year when UFC is out on the open market, and can they make a significant pitch for the UFC? I would state that if they lose the NBA, which I think many look at that solution, frees up a lot for them to go after something big like the UFC, and the UFC definitely benefits from the fact that they're going to have multiple bidders out there. And it was not lost on me, and it's a small thing, but on Saturday's pay-per-view broadcast, many people were noting all these production issues on the ESPN Plus pay-per-view. Like, they had the wrong, like, NFL graphics coming up, and Dana White was asked about this afterward. And listen, Dana White is a very smart player when it comes to how honest he's going to be or protecting a partner. And dude, he just like, yeah, ESPN was having a pretty bad night. I mean, he threw it for a guy that always says how, you know, he champions the fact we control our production. But this was all an ESPN issue, all these production glitches and such. And he's probably not wrong. It probably was the ESPN Plus side of things but he certainly was not going out of his way to come to the defense of ESPN. He just said, yeah, it was really poorly handled.
This is what I appreciate about Dana White. Now, there are a lot of issues around Dana White, and I know, John, you've had your run-ins with him as well, but like, he in these press conferences, I get the impression that he's pretty forthright and honest. Like, can you imagine in either WWE or AEW, Paul Levesque or Tony Khan ever saying something like this about a major business partner? Never.
No, like I'm not going to say you're always getting the God's honest truth from Dana White. I think he will absolutely obscure and lie, but you are much more likely than any of those figures you cited that, I mean, he will also be very outspoken, even when it comes to partners and such like that. And I think people appreciate that from Dana White. You can list a lot of negative to Dana White, but there's like he commands his own kind of cult of personality with it. And there's a reason that people are so drawn to a Dana White in those situations.
And one more thing about the NBA, they are getting their TV rights fees more than doubled. They're going from WBD and ESPN to ESPN, Amazon, and NBC. And actually, NBC has bid more than any of the others. And that bodes well, at least for WWE's upcoming PLE, Peacock rights that are coming up, and for UFC, I would say. At least that was a takeaway from Morgan Stanley in their TKO analysis that came out a couple weeks ago, that this indicates that there still is a healthy sports rights market. The counter to that would be, well, this is the NBA. This is the second most valuable sports property that there is. Of course, that's the one that's going to survive and still benefit here. Do the others further down the list benefit as much?
And I think UFC is going to be attached to that narrative for the next year and a half. Is like UFC, they're not the NBA, they're not the NFL. But you could argue like they are, I would argue they are about as valuable as, say, like an NHL level, maybe, you know, above that tier to some, because they come with a pay-per-view component attached to them. And it's going to be sort of, where is a UFC? And if they get a great benefit, I think you kind of get that halo effect on all these other properties that, yeah, sports is still in demand. It's not just the big ones like NBA and NFL. It's that B level of packages as well. We can talk a bit about this Morgan Stanley report. As Brandon mentioned, it came out a few weeks ago and they've increased their price target for the TKO stock up to $115 per share. And the big pillars that they're citing for their optimism for the stock is the upcoming rights for both the UFC domestic rights and the WWE PLE rights, and the escalating site fees that they see growing dramatically over the next years at about, they estimate the site fees to be around $200 million in 2024, and they can see that growing up to $300 in 2028 and a top line of potentially $400 million 5 years from now, which seems like a gigantic increase, but one that they seem very confident that this is only the start of TKO aggressively selling their major events. And we've even had the discussion about the potential of, you know, WWE wanting to sell its television shows, which seem like I don't know how many millions a 3 hour Raw will bring.
But maybe packaged with a UFC Fight Night or something. Maybe that makes sense. And that puts more value in there. My takeaway is that their view is that the market is a little bit too bullish about TV rights, but not bullish enough about site fees. As we were discussing earlier, I'm sure the Saudi Arabia events are already being calculated into that number that they're talking about, 200 and what did they say? 200 currently, correct?
Yes.
And 300 to 400, they see that growing to over the next 5 years or so. I'm sure the $50 million per event, $100 million per year is part of that. And I guess we should remember that there's been hints around whether or not Saudi Arabia is going to get a Royal Rumble or a WrestleMania someday. And I'm sure the site fee associated with that would be enormous. So there's those things. And you would know more about UFC's site fees in the Middle East. They've got a deal with Saudi Arabia now. They've had deals with Abu Dhabi, correct?
Yes.
UAE. So there's all that as well.
Yeah, I think the Saudi Arabia component is going to, like, when we're talking about that, like, literally two shows out of the entire calendar make up half of that $200 million figure, coming from the WWE side. So think about what, the UFC just ran its first event in Saudi Arabia. We also know that Saudi Arabia is sponsoring this upcoming card at the Sphere, which, Dana White has stated they have already spent $17 million on production for this event at the Sphere, and they just released the ticket prices. We'll get into those afterwards. Folks, you are Saudi Arabia and you, the consumer, are footing the bill for this show at the Sphere. Get in price, $3,000, Brandon.
$3,000. And I've seen Fightful was reporting a couple days ago about the notion of whether or not there would be wrestling shows at the Sphere. I can't see that happening.
I can't.
How expensive it is. I like maybe like a WrestleMania type level, but that's always going to be in a stadium, I feel like. So I can't imagine a pro wrestling show at any time in the next few years, at least, happening at the Sphere.
Not at this level of cost. I just like UFC, like they have flat out stated this is one and done. That's it. Like this is way too expensive for them. I mean, I don't know what the Saudi Arabian government is kicking in for this. I'm sure it's not insignificant, but yeah, we're seeing tickets that are approximately ranging from $3,000 to $12,000 per ticket. And, the way that the seating has come out, like there is not an insignificant amount of just standing room only tickets on the floor. So like you're talking about standing for 10 fights over the course of 6-7 hours. And I mean, the amount of this is not an event for you, the average fan, by any stretch.
And has anything ever been televised in the Sphere? I know there's. Well, I guess the NHL draft was
the draft. I think is the only thing that's been televised itself. Yeah, which
they have rules about how you can't videotape, or you can't take pictures or both while you're at the Sphere.
Well, you might have a seizure if you're in this environment. God knows what the makeup is going to be.
But for people who don't know, it's like an entire wall of video. That's what the interior of this building is.
Yeah, I think Dana White, when asked about the NHL draft, he said that's going to look like children playing with crayons when they see what we do. The only other things from the Morgan Stanley report, they cited the fact that look what ESPN Plus has been able to do with its UFC pay-per-views. 4 price increases since the deal began in 2019. A UFC pay-per-view, when this deal started, you had to pay your $10 for ESPN Plus. Then on top of that, you had to pay the $10 for the right to buy the pay-per-view for $59.99. Now it's a $79.99 price tag, and the ESPN Plus subscription fee has also increased during that time. So it is not a insignificant expense. And I'd really be curious to see, like, I don't even know how they could even break this down and get like meaningful data on. But if you follow some of the, like the recent Nate Diaz fight with Jorge Masvidal, the recent Jake Paul fight, like, these are doing no numbers on pay-per-view, and yet they draw well. They sell tickets to these events, but they die on pay-per-view. And I can't attribute all of that to streaming, but I imagine like a good percentage of these people watching these cards are audiences that are adept at streaming. And I just wonder like how many UFC fans have gone that route over the life of this ESPN Plus deal as well. Like I'm sure it's like they have just price these at such a level that spending $80 for a pay-per-view, there's many people that are pretty sophisticated to figure out how you can watch a pay-per-view without spending $80. But nonetheless, this is...
You know how you can save a lot of money on pay-per-view.
NordVPN.com/post-wrestling. Yes, they didn't even pay for that particular
one. Is there a specific country where the price is especially low?
Malaysia, I was told, is the destination for UFC pay-per-views. You do have to pay, but it's a membership fee, and it's above board. So what more can you say here? And that was that. I'm curious to see if they have any reaction to, because two of the big, or at least one of the key things they mentioned here is the fact that these antitrust cases are out of the way for the UFC. So that, you know, the market certainly looked at that as like a very positive ruling. And now those antitrust cases, they just continue not to die, and they're back at the forefront. And the other thing here I did take away from this report was they cited a figure of F1 receiving around $35 million per race. And of course, a lot of these F1 races are taking place, overseas in the Middle East. And the idea being that it's not just the race, but a whole weekend that they create. And just seeing, you know, TKO, it's, are they looking at F1 sort of as a template where we can go to these places and it's not just one night, it's a series of events. Like we're seeing a soft launch of that now. Like, you look at SummerSlam this weekend, they've added all these live events. They've extended their countdown shows that people can attend. Like, you could go to Cleveland and you can have a weekend of various WWE events. You get SmackDown, you get SummerSlam, you get the stage shows. And I think that's their template.
Sami Zayn show again, right? And there's a Damian Priest.
A screening of his documentary is being done. And then you got the Undertaker show as well.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll be front row for the one dead man talk show.
I'll have to save up my money. But these are the size of I would say what a super indie show at least used to do, but you're putting it, I'm sure these are much higher ticket prices, right? And these are probably at least most cases nicer venues. So, and it's WWE being able to do that. And I'm not sure the indies, I mean, remember when SummerSlam was in Toronto, was that 2016 and all the indie events that were happening there?
2019. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Everything before the pandemic feels further away.
Not have the demand for the, like, they thought that was going to be a WrestleMania weekend type event, and there was just not.
Yeah. That's true.
It was just not, they overshot the idea of how many people would travel for SummerSlam weekend.
And is there any indie events like out of town other than local indie companies that you've heard of that are running events?
Game Changers in town on this weekend.
That's right.
That's the main one. But yeah, nothing like that 2019 weekend or anything that you would see in terms of it being this just, and I'm sure that people will remind me there's probably other like small shows going on, but I would say GCW is probably the most notable that's happening in the city in terms of a non Cleveland based company. All right. Let's chat a bit about, as I just spin the wheel here. Let's chat a bit about SummerSlam weekend. We mentioned the shows that are going on. Also worth noting is the fact that earlier this year, it had been reported something called the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit Program. They really need acronyms for all of these. They announced $36.7 million would be doled out in state tax credits for various productions. And we got a listing of companies receiving money from this fund, including WWE that received $1.6 million in February. Now, they don't state what the production is, but I think you can probably draw the conclusion that this is attached to SummerSlam this weekend. And also, AEW listed as receiving $1.275 million for this year and next. And I can also assume that this goes beyond their Collision taping on September 12th in Dayton. I imagine they're not getting $1.2 million for Collision.
Yeah. Well, in the case of the W1, this is not new news that they're getting a tax credit, that they are getting $2.675 million. I'm not even sure that this is the first time that they're getting a tax credit from Ohio. We don't talk about it that much, but there are definitely in Connecticut, in Louisiana,
Georgia,
Georgia. Okay. And, I think it's like, you know, when you see the end of the show and sometimes they'll show like this graphic of a state or something, I think that's telling you that there was tax credit or something here. That must be.
I'm pretty sure Georgia's like always had that. That's how you notice it, is like right at the end of the show, they have a quick graphic of some sort.
Yeah. So I looked at how this is calculated and it's something like 30% of your expense or something like that. So I don't know what to take away in terms of, you know, what this is going toward. Is this, would it have been that much different if they weren't doing SummerSlam in Cleveland? I don't know. Given how close the WWE number is to the AEW number, they're both in excess of $1 million, but less than two. I don't know that this tells us a lot about SummerSlam, and there may have been a separate deal for SummerSlam in Cleveland. But we know that there is a show coming up. What were the AEW shows that we know that are coming up in Ohio at this point?
There's just a September date, September 12th in Dayton. And I think that's the only Ohio date they have on the calendar for this year.
Yeah. Okay. And there are certain qualifications, like you have to be a production that's spending more than $300,000 and things like that.
Collision is going to air this Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern time. They wanted to get out of the way of SummerSlam. And instead, we're going to get Collision going head to head with the 3-hour SummerSlam pre-show that they have announced for 5 p.m. They're going to do a 3-hour pre-show.
In theory,
3 hours of, I can't make accusations. Maybe they just felt this was the time to extend our talking, because I can't tell you how many times I've sat down for that pre-show and my takeaway is this isn't long enough.
Right.
I wish I could get some more expanded thoughts on this 7-match card. Well, you will get that on Saturday. No matches announced for the kickoff. We'll see if they throw anything in there. But yes, you will get 3 hours of WWE pre-show going against, well, 2 hours of Collision on Saturday. I can almost sense a Fast National number coming down next week. Do you get that feeling? This feels like one of those weekends that I feel they're going to have a Fast National number.
Could be. And I would think that the rating for Collision will be lower than normal and lower than it was this past Saturday. So there might be some information out there about how low the Collision rating was.
Other notes here to go through. We had the double Tony Khan press conferences last week. He did a media call on Thursday where Brendan Thurston got to the bottom of when is this TV deal? What's going on, Tony? What's going on with this TV deal? And I'm sure Tony Khan, he was very close to just revealing everything, but he just...
Well, I think he did tell us that
He stated pretty matter-of-factly there's going to be an increase. It was not we're hoping for an increase. No, there is going to be an increase. He stated that there pretty is
not
clearly.
It would be premature, he said. Premature was his choice of word. There is not a deal done in principle, which is what has been reported. Now, I think could be the case is that there could have been an offer, a term sheet, but it wasn't agreed to. It wasn't finalized. And there have been various speculations and beliefs about when the exclusive negotiating window ends with WBD. He was speaking on Thursday, and he was speaking in passing about the exclusive negotiating window that they were still within. So as of Thursday, they were still in the window with only, was now what, 5 months to go? So maybe it just ended though, because you know the 28th is one day date that's been speculated. So who knows? But I think they're going to go try to talk to other bidders, see how much interest there is in other content. Would be shocked if at least some of the content does not remain with WBD. I would expect that most of the content will remain. Maybe all of it will remain. But they will find out how much this content is worth. As I've continued to say, Amazon and Fox seem like the most plausible bidders. The thing that you're looking for is not only money, but reach. Fox certainly has reach. I don't see AEW being on the Fox broadcast network, but that would be attractive to them, I'm sure. So we'll find out. And finding out how many bidders there are, how aggressively those bidders are willing to bid is going to be the biggest factor that determines whether or not AEW gets a great deal, which Tony Khan is overwhelmingly confident that they are getting a huge, huge increase. He continues to be in these comments and in prior comments. Another interesting takeaway, I don't know if I'm jumping ahead, but he did the press conference in person after the Ring of Honor Death Before Dishonor pay-per-view, where he seemed determined to bring up the idea that maybe Ring of Honor will become rebranded as AEW Ring of Honor, which will help them, presumably, was his insinuation that will help them with media rights negotiations.
And he doesn't believe that would be sacrilegious to do so.
No. No, don't worry.
I don't think you're going to have a brigade showing up.
I mean, this is going to really upset all the ROH hardcores out there who love their Honor Club, all 12,000 of them or whatever it is who actually subscribe to Honor Club.
Yes, which was our last figure that we got like about 2 years ago. So I don't know what the Honor Club figure is now. No, I think that makes all the sense in the world that you would put the breast branding forward. And I think this would really, this is just like your latest example that it would state that. You know, he's mentioned many times the fact that, you know, ROH is in the mix in these negotiations. And I think there's a real aversion to the branding of Ring of Honor when it comes to Warner Brothers Discovery for whatever reason. They are clearly in business with the AEW brand of professional wrestling, and ROH is just something they are not interested in.
Yeah, that's my sense. I think I heard somewhere, read somewhere that, you know, WBD took a look at Ring of Honor, you know, in the Sinclair era and was not interested in it. So, you know, why would they be interested in, they're in business with AEW. So why would they be interested in Ring of Honor? And all indications point to the notion that AEW did try to get, or Tony Khan did try to get Ring of Honor programming onto some sort of WBD platform, and was not able to do so, obviously, given that they've got a weekly show on their own self-owned streaming service. So, maybe it's something for True TV. That seems possible too, that True TV is supposed to pivot into more of a sports strategy. So maybe Ring of Honor fits there.
There was also this story yesterday from Bloomberg Law of I'll just read from the story here. A woman-led legal team with experience litigating cases involving sexual misconduct should take the lead in challenging World Wrestling Entertainment's $21.4 billion merger with MMA giant the UFC. An attorney for an Ohio pension fund argued on Tuesday before the Delaware Chancery Court. Investor Dennis Palkin and the Laborers District Council and Contractors Pension Fund of Ohio are vying with the city of Pontiac reestablished general employees retirement system. Again, another necessary acronym to lead the consolidated litigation. The competing complaints argue that Vince McMahon and other WWE senior leaders orchestrated an unfair merger with the league owned by Endeavor Group Holdings. So it would seem that, after a year, this merge is going to just fall apart and they'll go their separate ways.
So this is totally new to me, but this is about an existing class action case, or at least shareholder lawsuit case that we've known about, right? This Dennis Palkin case.
Yes.
And what are they saying? That they need to hire lawyers who are women? Is that what they're saying? Or they already have lawyers who are women?
Yes.
Yes. The latter.
The latter. Yes. Okay. Correct.
Okay. And this is going to pull apart the merger. The writer believes that. That's going to happen?
Well, that's that they're arguing that this was done in that those that led the merger did so. I guess they feel that there was improprieties in.
Yeah. As I recall, the case that's being made by the plaintiffs here who are suing WWE and probably TKO is that this was that Vince McMahon predetermined the company, Ari Emanuel Endeavor, that he was going to make the deal with, and that there wasn't a genuine bidding process. A genuine shopping around of various partners to get the best deal for investors. Therefore, investors were harmed because they weren't given the best deal. And Vince just decided ahead of time he was going to make a deal with his friend Ari.
Yeah, which I think is a super difficult argument to make, given the fact that we know from the fact that Vince McMahon, for whatever you want to say about Ari Emanuel's decision to keep Vince McMahon, Vince McMahon ended up getting a way better deal for shareholders by his involvement in this company, where they increased the equity that they would have by him staying on board, and got a better deal because of his involvement with the company. And I think it'd be very hard to look at the makeup of this company that this was somehow done in bad faith, or that this harmed people.
And WWE has already published in their filings their own narrative about what happened, and they've anonymized who the suitors were. I think it's probably like Comcast, and maybe there was a Saudi government suitor in there as well. Gosh, what's the Formula One company? Liberty Media seems to be another one. So that's their side of the story. This lawsuit in particular has been hard to follow because it's in Delaware Chancery Court, which is not something that's covered by Pacer, and you have to like use a system that costs like $45 per document or something like that to get into this. So I haven't been following it that closely.
Well, you can maybe sign up for the Delaware Chancery Court updates and get a UFC Sphere ticket.
We have a UFC statement. We have a TKO statement here that has just dropped through the IR website. We'll put it on the screen here. This is like a press release. I don't know if it's going to say anything different than what's in the 8K. This is from UFC issue statement regarding Lee and Johnson antitrust settlement ruling. We obviously disagree with this ruling and believe it disregards the expertise of counsel from both sides, as well as that of an accomplished and expert mediator, all of whom have decades of experience in antitrust law. It provides, it prevents the athletes from receiving what they have argued is in their best interest, and unwinds an extensively negotiated settlement that, in the plaintiff's counsel's own words, quote, would far surpass the typical antitrust class action settlement and is an excellent result for the settlement classes by all traditional measures, end quote. Additionally, by taking the unusual step of denying the settlement in this preliminary approval stage, the judge is also denying the athletes their right to be heard during this pivotal moment in the case. And there's a little bit more here.
That's very rich that they're going to argue about the athletes are not being heard here, when they also have worked into the UFC fighters language. If you ever have a legal dispute, you cannot take us to court. You have to do it privately in arbitration as well. But I digress. As we've said throughout this process, we believe strongly in the merits of our cases and are evaluating all of our options, including, without limitation, an appeal, and have initiated discussions with plaintiff's counsel who have expressed a willingness to engage in separate settlement discussions of the Lee and Johnson cases. So not exactly
with the statement that you got there. Yeah.
Yeah. Not exactly a parallel statement to what, the plaintiff side had stated, although the connective is they are both willing to sit down and engage in talks. And I mean, my thought would be that they will likely come together for, I mean, I would need some better expertise on what the options are, particularly of TKO, of appealing this, or what the next steps are to take. I mean, do you need to come back with a kind of revised settlement, or is there a case to be made if both sides believe that this is fair? Like, you're not, it's weird when you have the judge that is the dissenting party in this between plaintiff and defendant. I don't even know what the next step would be in this process.
I'm sure UFC feels like the judges, the judges kind of become their lawyer here and overruled their own counsel.
Yeah. He has in many ways. Like, I understand his thought process, and I think there's, it's the idea of pursuing this that you can obviously see why TKO does not want to pursue this further. But also on the plaintiff side, you can see like the gamble, like they're happy to cash out at this stage of the game. We've been grinding at this for 10 years, and this might be our best offer that we can get. It's not an insignificant amount, and we could be risking that by going forward. But
and we would need to talk to a lawyer again. We've had a few to discuss this topic, but I do wonder. And maybe the judge views it this way, is that, you know, look, you've got all these workers here who are misclassified. Maybe there are larger issues here that $335 million doesn't, you know, justly resolve.
Final things here. We will, let's just chat a bit of television numbers going against the Olympics, which have now taken over television. Are you watching any of the Olympics, Brandon?
Oh, absolutely. Every day there's the Olympics on my home 24/7, kind of.
We haven't talked about this, but I mean, Peacock just did their recent earnings call, and the subscriber figure for Peacock was down a little bit. They announced 33 million paid subscribers, but like they are touting the fact of the success of these Olympics on Peacock, and like they're doing like millions of viewers on Peacock. I wonder what the incremental increase has been over this last week for the Olympics, and if there's any kind of effect that WWE receives, given that they have a big show coming up on Saturday and potentially like a new pool of subscribers that might be checking out SummerSlam that did not have access to Peacock before this week.
We'll see if W tells us that this was the most watched SummerSlam ever. And I think that would give you an indication of that. Yes, this was for the opening ceremony. NBC Sports said there were 28.6 million viewers. Nielsen measured NBC at 15 million. So I haven't looked into this. I assume this was also airing on USA and other networks.
Yeah, too. NBC, all their press releases, it's combining everything together. NBC, USA, and Peacock, and whatever other distribution methods they have. And they're just baking it all in towards this. Total audience delivery, which I feel is a... there we have the acronym TAD. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to be getting a lot of TAD over the next generation of viewership. Maybe that's what we'll hear for that first Raw on Netflix. TAD. Yeah. Worldwide audience delivery. How about that one? WAD.
Yes. Global audience delivery. GAD.
Oh, okay. Even better. International.
Yeah, global sounds big and powerful. Round.
Well, SmackDown on Friday night did 2,058,000 viewers and a 0.52. So this was actually their lowest demo of the year and their lowest audience since June. And
against that opening ceremony.
Against the opening ceremonies. Although in Canada, they did their largest number in Canada since the night before WrestleMania. So we do not care about the Olympics, obviously. Rampage that same night, 306,000 viewers and a 0.10, featuring the Royal Rampage Battle Royal that took up 2/3 of the show. Looks like people were not necessarily checking out the Royal Rampage. Collision on Saturday night. This was airing against both the Olympics and the UFC prelims. 382,000 viewers and a 0.12 in the demo. In particular, they fell 46% in 18 to 34. And like Brandon, correct me if I'm wrong, but that seems to be the consistent area that you are seeing AEW. Like a lot of these numbers are, it's the 18 to 34 number that seems to be the one that is the most volatile when it comes to like these week to week performances.
this chart would tell you that. Let's see. So 18 to 34 in terms of the months, it is, I don't know. It's July, which is almost over here. It's down 38%, which is almost the same as total viewership. But I mean, there's, I don't know. I think they're both. I mean, if anything, it looks like from this chart that the total viewership is a little more volatile.
Well, we also had Battle of the Belts.
Yes.
For those that wanted the third hour of AEW, 308,000 viewers, 0.09. So this was the second lowest demo in Battle of the Belts history. And I believe it's lowest viewership to date. That was from 10 to 11 Eastern on TNT. And then we had Raw on Monday night, which they moved to Sci-Fi, and they did a hell of a job promoting this move to Sci-Fi. They just inundated you with ads last week, and that generated 1,412,000 viewers and a 0.51 in the 18 to 49 demographic. So,
and they outperformed what was on USA Network, which was Olympics coverage. I don't know what kind. Now the main Olympics coverage was on NBC, but whatever was on USA, Raw did better than on Sci-Fi.
They were only down 13% in the demo moving to Sci-Fi. I would say that's a very strong retention for.
And this is something that they love to push, especially with the notion that they're going to change networks, which they are going to, this show is going to go to Netflix and SmackDown is going to go from Fox to USA. Is that our, this is, I think Nick Khan has said this exact thing. Our viewers follow us wherever we are. So it gets to the notion that no matter how strong or weak your platform is, as long as it's available to our fans, they're going to go there. And they're going to watch our show.
Yeah.
And this does support that. I mean, you've gone from Sci-Fi, which is its distribution is probably similar, but it's a much lower profile network than USA is. And like week to week, this was down 21%, but only down 14% in the demo. This is not bad. They've done three Raws on Sci-Fi. They did two in 2022 and they held up okay. So we'll see what happens with NXT when that rating comes out.
The saying. Great American Bash.
Yep.
I predict the Great American Bash, terrible number in the US, and it just soars through the roof in Canada. That's my prediction. Okay. That's how these numbers typically work. All right. You are now all up to date as we have gone through a ton of news items today. We'll see how much of it is all dated within 24 hours. But Brandon and I are off to Cleveland this weekend. We will be heading to SummerSlam on Saturday night at Cleveland Browns Stadium.
Yes. And get your threats ready.
Yo, get them ready. Just put them in your drafts now so that you can be ready just to send them out immediately at us. So there you go. If we see you in Cleveland, do say hello, unless you don't want to. You are under no obligation to do so. But Brandon will be at the Undertaker talk show.
You can just watch us in passing and be like, that's Paul and Thurston.
Yeah, that's it. Just point.
That's enough. That's fine with me too.
All right. Check out a free edition of WrestleNomics Radio that's coming at you this weekend at a time and date to be determined.
It'll be Monday. We'll see.
Wei and I are back tonight. We have Rewind to Dynamite after tonight's show from Greenville, South Carolina. We will be chatting about that 10:05 Eastern at the Post Wrestling YouTube channel. And then we will be continuing our G1 coverage that you can check out postwrestlingcafe.com if you want to support us as you can, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. So thank you to everybody in the chat for following along, and we will be back here next Wednesday for the post SummerSlam show. What will the world of professional wrestling look like 7 days from now? Only one way to find out, by subscribing to both channels, and we'll speak with you then.